Welcome to It's No Secret, a podcast for Kiwis who want their money questions answered.
Ready, steady, go.
This podcast will answer the money questions you may or may not have on your mind. We'll talk to real Kiwis and share truths about our own financial lives.
Both the successes and the failures. Because the truth is, there is no secret to achieving financial freedom.
Hello and welcome to It's No Secret. I'm Christine.
And I'm Kat.
And today on the podcast, we are doing another Q&A, money Q&A with Kat and I, and we are talking about all things tax, because tax, end of financial year, is fast approaching, and why not talk about this now?
Sure.
Since no one else wants to talk about it for the rest of the year. well, or is that just me?
Well, no, that's fair, Yeah.
So we've got a few questions lined up, and I'm definitely going to be relying heavily on you today,
which is really concerning because I'm also not a tax expert. So we're just going to preface this conversation by this is absolutely not tax advice. If you have some deep personal questions about tax that you want to get the nitty-gritty on, go and ask your accountant. Search on the IRD. There is lots of information there.
Love it.
This will be general.
Yeah,
don't at me if I don't answer your question.
Yeah, good. Good. Okay. Number one.
Yeah.
Let's start with, how important is tax when investing?
Love this question because someone actually asked us this at Kernel last week. They basically were like, hey, so if I read this blog correctly, it tells me that the tax treatment of New Zealand shares is better than the tax treatment of investing in global shares. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at investing in more global shares, but maybe I should not.
Yeah.
And we had a really good debate in the CS team about that. If all else was equal and you were only deciding whether or not to, well, what to invest in based on tax, as a Kiwi paying tax in New Zealand, investing in New Zealand, like investing in shares on the NZX would be a much better tax outcome than investing in, say, the US 500.
Yep.
But people don't just invest on the basis of tax. No, and that was not really typically advisable because there is a whole thing of like diversification and, you know, markets do different things, countries do different things, making sure that we have exposure to other parts of economies and sectors and all that kind of stuff. So it is important in the sense that if you are running through an investment checklist of like, what am I going to invest in and why, you would start with some more high level questions of like, what's my goal? What's my risk tolerance? What's my like desired outcome of investing here? And probably when you get to like the first or fourth or fifth order question, you would probably then think of like, okay, well,
how does tax
fit in? Yeah. What is the most efficient from a tax point of view way to invest in this investment option or market? And that was when it would start to come in. But I would not advise someone to be thinking of that as their primary decision point at the start.
Nice. And so once you get to point four or five, like what is the role that it plays? Like, how does it impact your investing?
Yeah. So I think it narrows down your choices around things like making sure you understand, is the asset class or investment you're looking at taxed under RWT, which is resident withholding tax rates, or is it taxed under a different scheme, most commonly a PIR, so prescribed investor rate under the PI structure.
Okay.
That's probably your first, like, I guess, decision point, because for most people, their RWT rate and their PIR rate will be different. RWT is on the spectrum of 10.5% to 39% based on your income. PIR rates, however, are 10.5% to 28% based on your income, and they're capped at 28%. So if you are a higher income earner on either a 30, 33, or 39 RWT rate, you would have an incentive to look at some investment options that allow you to enable being taxed at the 28% PIR rate cap.
And what are those investments?
PIE funds.
Yeah.
I'll keep it at that.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Because basically, it's like to achieve or to be taxed under the PIR regime or like the PIE rate, you need to be investing in a vehicle that's under the PIE fund structure.
Yep,
so people often think like, oh, how do I pick to be invested, like taxed at my PIR rate? You're not picking to be taxed at that rate versus your RWT rate. You're choosing an investment vehicle that is subject to the PIR rules.
Yep.
And that's typically a PIE fund or an investment that's under a PIE structure. Most notably for everybody, all KiwiSaver funds are PIE funds.
Great. That's a good distinction.
Yep. So, I mean, hot tip is like most people that are currently investing in a KiwiSaver, like it will be under a PIE fund structure, and you would have been asked when you signed up with your provider to select your PIR rate being 10.5%, 17.5%, or 28%. And this is different to obviously your RWT.
Cool.
Yeah.
This is just a random question. Is that like an incentive by KiwiSaver, the scheme?
I think so. I don't know the history of it, but I'm guessing that like the history of PIE funds and the tax regime around that was probably somewhat linked to the history of KiwiSaver.
Yeah, cool. Nice. Love it. Great. And so what the heck is the fifth tax regime? And I laugh because I feel like I don't, you still just don't fully understand.
I mean, look, I don't fully understand all the ins and outs of fifth tax because the long and the short of it is that I don't need to. So if you go back to the conversation that we just had on, you know, what tax rate are you being kind of taxed on for your investments? Is it an investment that falls under RWT or is it an investment that falls under your PIR rate? This is also a good differentiator to consider or think about how FIF tax then applies. So FIF tax, for people that don't know, is foreign investment fund tax. This is a different tax that applies to a New Zealander owning global shares, essentially, or like global holdings. Back to that like top question, that's the consideration this person was asking of, I know that there is a tax difference between owning New Zealand companies and how I'd be taxed on those versus owning overseas companies and how I'd be taxed on those. The FIF regime is very complicated, and basically how it kind of pans out is that depending on how you're investing, and by that I mean, are you investing through a fund or are you owning a share directly, will determine how the FIF tax applies to you. Also thinking about how the investment that you're owning is structured and run also dictates how the FIF tax applies to you. And what I mean by that is, are you owning a direct share on the like US stock exchange? Are you owning a ETF on the US stock exchange that then holds other underlying investments? Are you owning a
unlisted
fund based out of Australia that is then holding other investments on your behalf? That also varies how the FIF regime applies to you as an individual. And then on top of that, the FIF regime, just to make it really fun and more complicated, has two different measures that one could use in any given year to figure out how they would apply tax. So this gets most complicated for people that own direct shares or ETFs in their own personal name that they are kind of managing. So if you're on like one of the broking platforms and you're investing in the US markets or international markets, you will be used to them telling you that you need to basically do your own FIF tax reporting, and you would typically need to have an accountant, and there's various thresholds that people talk about. Most commonly, it becomes more complicated once you have more than $50,000 invested in any of those holdings. That is a little bit more complicated than, say, you hold a PIE fund, i.e. the Kernel Global 100, that does have holdings across various global markets, including the US. They would typically be taxed still under the FIF regime, but in a different way. And you as the end user would have arguably less to do on like that behalf, basically, because you've got that intermediary being the fund manager to do some of the tax legwork for you.
Yeah, nice.
People get really caught up in it, like so caught up in like, I don't know, trying to just squeeze out the best dollar and structure. And it's like, if you just take that higher level approach of thinking, okay, how much overseas investment exposure do I want to have? You know, what is my RWT tax rate? For me right now, I'm on 33%. So I immediately know that it makes logical sense for me to consider something that's taxed at 28. Like that's a no-brainer. Why would I, you know, there's very little tax hacks that you can make in New Zealand. That is just one of them that for me is a no-brainer. So then I'm like, okay, I've narrowed down my options to things that are taxed under a PIE fund structure. Let's look at the PIE funds. Then let's see what they have to say about how their funds are treated for tax. pick one that's optimized for tax or actually gives a shit. That's probably a good starting point. Or is happy to engage in the conversation with you. And then from there, invest in that fund. And even better, because it's through the PIE fund structure, they're handling that tax for me.
I also find it quite interesting because they're like the percentage, I guess, you know, taken off, let's say, in return after fees and tax can actually be quite impactful when you consider tax relative to, you know, like a lot of people think about, oh, how do I choose a fund that gives the best return or whatever, but like by not thinking about tax, you're potentially missing out on like the difference else. You know, like at the after fee return that you would be when deciding between two different funds.
Exactly. So I think, you know, if you are, in a bracket, I mean, there's no like disadvantage from a tax point of view to investing in a PIE fund structure, even at the lower income brackets, because you can still pick a PIR rate of
lower than 28.
So it's more just one of those things of like, if you're on a trajectory where, let's say you're earning right now and you're at the rate of 17.5%, if you feel like you could get beyond the 30% rate, then of course it would be worthwhile you considering having your investments in a structure that on the whole is taxed at a lower rate.
Yeah, nice. Love it.
Yep.
Cool. Okay. Second to last question. I am a, or scenario, I'm a full-time employee and I want to pick up a side job / contracting.
Love this.
What does this mean for me tax-wise?
Love that. So, I mean, there's a lot of information on this on the ID website, but I would also point someone that is thinking about this in the direction of, say, the likes of Henry, because the kind of, I guess, caveat starting point to think of is if you get this wrong in the first instance, you don't want to be hit with an unexpected tax bill at the end of financial year and then have to front up some cash that you haven't set aside. Equally, once that does happen, and let's say you consider your side hustle contracting, you may then be put onto a like payment plan, a forward payment plan with the IRD, which is basically like their way of ensuring that you then don't in year two get hit with the tax bill at the end, and you need to make sure that that's happening in its you know, the most streamlined manner, not a manner that's like more challenging for you. So definitely try and use another service to basically help you outsource with that. If you don't want to use an accountant, you could use Henry or you could use Xero, depending on your complexity. The general kind of gist tax-wise, though, is that with a secondary income, you do get taxed at a higher rate than your primary income. I don't really understand that. I'm just going to make a real general statement here. Someone else can jump onto that, because what kind of confuses me, and this is why someone, you know, just to give Australia another shout out of why they're great, but how it basically works in Australia is you're taxed on like your universal income and the brackets just go up, right? So if I had seven jobs, it wouldn't matter because I would just be taxed on the cumulative income total of my seven jobs, as opposed to in New Zealand, you have your tax code if you're a regular employee, which I think is M.
Or
something like, else if you've got a student loan, line, it's like MS or something like that. So let's just say you're a regular M. You're being taxed at a normal rate, but if you are like secondary income, you get taxed at a default slightly higher rate. From the first dollar earned.
Why does Australia just do everything so much better?
I mean, I don't know. I think they've just really got their tax system nutted out. It does. I think that, you know, the general gist is still at the end of the day, you get taxed. Like the outcome is still sort of the same. You're not penalized for like having a second job, but it does just mean that you need to make sure you are adequately setting aside enough of your own tax, particularly if you're contracting and you're being paid on a gross amount. You need to make sure you're considering things like GST, whether or not you're applying that. You also need to make sure that you're actually setting aside like whatever it is, your one third or more, to be building up your own little tax savings pool. Because it catches people out all the time.
I feel like it's also a good instance where you would want to see an accountant, because you know, in the same way that a lot of contractors claim back, you know, on their office space or phone usage or whatever else, like you could probably do that as well. Last edge case question, which I don't know if you can answer, but I'm personally a US tax citizen. So if I am like a tax resident in another country, or if I'm maybe not a, like I'm not a Kiwi citizen or whatever, are there other things that I should be thinking about?
Yep, there definitely are. I mean, I think if you have any kind of citizenship or like tax obligation to any other country, you definitely want to have an accountant. You probably yep. just want to make sure that you're not necessarily doing all of your own like end of year reporting and tax by yourself. Yep. The reason that I say that is even if you feel like you don't have any tax obligations that you need to report ongoing, you just need to really make sure that that is the case. So mm-hmm. you're not then hit with a surprise like 5 years down the track.
Yep.
The other thing that also I think on the like tax citizen point is, it's the wrong word, but what confuses people a lot, like the US is an anomaly, mm-hmm. but for other countries, generally speaking, you yep. are only a tax resident of one country at a time.
Yep.
So if you are right now, regardless of whether or not you're a New Zealand citizen, mm-hmm. if you are living and working in New Zealand and you qualify to be a tax resident of New Zealand, it is not common that you would then also have mm-hmm. tax paying obligations in another country, mm-hmm. Unless you mm-hmm. owned assets in that other country and then you have things like dual tax treaties. Yeah, so right. as an example, when Luke and I first moved back to New Zealand, we still owned a house in Australia that mm-hmm. was an investment property. We earned income on that investment property. We had to pay tax on that investment income.
Yeah.
We had to declare that in our New Zealand tax return because we were living and working and paying tax in New Zealand. So we were yep. deemed New Zealand tax residents. Mm-hmm. But all we needed to do, because Australia and New Zealand have a dual tax treaty, is basically confirm with the IRD that we had declared and paid our tax in Australia.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Huh. Yeah. And so then mm-hmm. we essentially got a like credit for some of it that's paid like taxed on a higher rate. It's yep. basically just making sure that you're not paying tax on the same income twice.
Yeah, right.
That's essentially what a dual tax treaty does. Mm-hmm. But the end result is like you have to be paying tax in somewhere for one of those assets.
Yeah.
So yeah. that's kind of the trigger is yeah. like if I have yeah. other assets or other money in another country that I feel like I should be paying tax on, yeah. if I'm not paying tax on that money in New Zealand, mm. am I paying tax on that money in the other country, and do I feel confident that I kind of know what I'm doing with those two things?
Yeah.
And if, yeah, I would say that's kind of a general like trigger complexity warning, like yeah. go yeah. and see an accountant.
Yeah.
You know, in that instance, mm-hmm. when that was happening, we had an accountant in Australia and an accountant in New Zealand for all of those years that did both of our tax returns. And it was only once we sold the house and things basically became far more like less complex and we declared that we no longer needed to do tax returns in Australia, did we kind of revert to having more simple tax processing here.
Yeah, nice. Nice. Yep. Love it. I think a very similar scenario happened with my sister when with the US, because she we have to declare in both countries, yes. obviously, and she owns a home and has some other assets. And so like she was a little bit nervous that she would have to be paying a lot more tax, but it actually turned out that because she was paying tax on it here, then they just wanted to kind of know.
Confirm.
Really. So
exactly.
Yeah, that was it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Nice. So, yeah. Cool.
Love that.
Yeah, that kind of wraps up all the tax questions.
What a tax.
Oh, no, actually,
joy.
One more. Sorry.
Oh, gosh.
Sorry, okay. Sorry. This is actually quite an important for those of us okay. that have a trust.
Okay.
So there are some changes to the
coming
way that
yep.
trusts are taxed. Yep. And so the question is, should I put my investments in a trust or not?
Yes.
Does this give me any benefits? Like, what's the change?
Should I move them out of a trust?
Exactly.
If I have them in trust.
Yep.
So I guess just the high level detail on what is currently changing, as we talked about before with the RWT tax rates, they go up to 39% for individuals. Right now, the trust rate stops at 33%. But from the 1st of April, so next financial year, this is increasing the top rate up to 39%. Mm-hmm. Now, if you think about the types of people that have money in trusts, usually it's because they are wanting to protect it for a certain reason. And if they're wanting to protect it, it's probably because it's a larger amount of money.
Yep.
So you're more likely to be dealing with people that have money well, that are on the higher rate,
yep.
right? So they are looking mm-hmm. at a change from, you know, a 33% to a 39% rate, which is fairly significant, and also makes the change of potentially looking to different investment options, i.e. considering like investments that are taxed at a PIR of 28% a lot more
attractive.
Yep. Exactly. In terms of the question around whether or not you should therefore move investments entirely out of a trust or even set up a trust, it is a little bit more of a bigger discussion than just tax.
Mm.
You know, for a lot of people, they will have reasons to have a trust around like protection or
like the family estate home planning
or you know, the fact that they just have complicated family situations, all that kind of stuff. I think like that's when it comes back to your first question of like, at what point does trust become a priority on that ranking? Like if you were in a trust originally because tax was the number one consideration, then well, there's a change to tax. You should start like reconsidering that or have a look at your options now. If, however, tax was like, you know, third or fourth order down below stuff like having a blended family or having complex family needs or needing a trust to look after a like special needs individual, all that kind of stuff will rank much more highly than perhaps like tax consequences. So it's a case of, definitely talk to an accountant or your lawyer about it. I think one of the things is that it definitely puts pause on people thinking about whether or not they would even open a trust and whether or there are better ways that you can manage risk by holding shares in – well, investments rather, individually through other like legal agreements, contracting out agreements if your concern is to do with partners, that kind of stuff. Like you can still protect yourself as an individual investment owner and still have the benefit of a lower tax rate as opposed to necessarily needing a whole new structure. The other thing I guess is that then you – it also puts light on like – people would potentially consider a corporate entity structure because, again, lower tax rate, but totally different ballgame in terms of like how, therefore, certain assets are taxed under capital gains scenarios and other things. So I say this because I basically I was talking to the accountant and basically the two options were like a corporate entity or a trust entity, but the primary decision point around both of those was entirely to do with like what do you want to have happen to the investments in those structures? How long are you holding them for? Wanting to have debt associated with them? Like none of it was tax-based, essentially. Yep. There was one minor outcome when basically off the back of me saying, well, there is a possibility that scenario A would happen and there's a possibility that scenario B would happen. And they were like, okay, if scenario A, this structure wouldn't be optimal for tax. Therefore, if either of those are a possibility, we would look at another one.
Yep.
But neither of them were from a point of view of like, let's optimize your situation for tax. And very uneducated read into that is because my current situation is not optimized.
It's not
optimized.
So it is like, optimized.
Well, having it in my individual name is not like a penalty. Right? It's not like we're being taxed on this investment in the future at like 45%. It's still at what would be my RWT at whatever point in time, which may be 39, may not be. And so, it was less of a tax-driven conversation. In fact, it was not at all driven by tax and it was more of a what could be optimal structuring for our investments, debt tied to some of those investments and how long we plan to keep them, plus some estate planning considerations.
Oh, so that was the driver for having the conversation in the first place.
Okay. So, in summation, tax is always a second order decision.
Yeah.
Or maybe sometimes a fourth.
Yeah, fourth, fifth. Blonde question, but like in my head, I feel like we've talked about trust relative to like equity investments, but what about with home? You know, like
it is
the same, right? It's because my house, what?
If you owned your house in your personal name, versus
like
in a trust,
what am I currently being taxed on?
Well, nothing. But I guess where people, but that, I mean,
but investment property is different.
Yes, investment property is different, and then also people used to buy trusts. Houses and trusts a lot more because they were worried about the asset protection thing. But then I guess the kind of flow-on effects of just maintaining and operating a trust have become a little bit more burdensome from a time and cost point of view. And so you weigh that up against – and that was also part of this discussion with the accountant is they're like, you know, if you go down this option for entities, you're going to have, let's say, like $2,000 a year ongoing costs. Yeah. You need to make sure that that is worth it for what is the likely outcome, you know, perhaps just keeping it vanilla – in a lot of ways is also fine. Yeah. I also look at all the investments, like, you know, you go and peruse some things on the company's register and you see how many people, how many wealthy people just have like
tax.
If you look at the Colonel Wealth Holdings share registry, there's not one single person that has a trust ownership.
But some that have companies, right? Because they're bought in groups or something like that.
Like nominee companies, which, but that's a different thing.
That's completely different. Yeah. Interesting.
So I look at some people and I'm like, I know you have like hundreds of millions of dollars and you don't invest in a trust. So maybe I should just not bother with maybe this you're onto whole a good like, thing. Yeah, like, you know, $2,000 to $3,000 a year of running costs and all the like admin burden with that. Like, I don't know. It's obvious. I just didn't feel like I was like totally disadvantaged, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's great. Great outcome for you.
Yeah. So in short, talk to an accountant.
Yeah.
Don't take our tax advice.
No.
Keep it simple.
There's lots on the IRD too.
Don't overthink it, particularly with the whole, I think, like FIF and global. It's like go back to those higher order questions of just, you know, what are you wanting to invest in and why and choose it. Yep. Choose it on the basis of goals and risk and diversification and then think, okay, well, is there a way that tax plays into like choosing a provider to meet that investment goal? And that's where you kind of look into it, but not so much as a point of view of like tax is the sole decision that I'm thinking about.
Love it. Perfect conclusion. Wonderful. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Please do not slide into our DMs with a tax question. Slide directly on over to the IRD website. But for any other questions, you can absolutely come over to It's No Secret NZ and we will happily answer you.
Do you have any accountants that you can recommend for anyone?
Oh, heaps. Yep. Yeah, if you're looking for an accountant, we actually know a lot of accountants in Auckland, in Christchurch, out of Auckland, all the things. So, yeah, if you're after an accountant, definitely
hit
us up. We
can help you with that. Yeah. DM us about that only.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All other tax questions, no.
Yeah. You can also ask us other money questions too that aren't tax. At It's No Secret NZ on Instagram.
Okay. All the questions.
Yeah. Okay. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks, Lisa.
Okay, bye.
Bye.